people, respect and information, education and a way to thrive is what you get on Warrior Connection and from Gary Nolan, the Progressive Radio Network. Not only Warrior Connection, but all the other shows are out there to provide you incredible information and ways to thrive. Well, we're going to continue on with it. Our co-host, Ray Clark, has an incredible individual. This is a friend and a neighbor of Ray's out there at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, in that area. And he's a U.S. Marine himself. I mean, as they all say, once a Marine, always a Marine. Right, Ray?
I'm afraid so. We pick up a lot of things that never leave, Doug. Yes.
But why don't you introduce our guest, and he can tell us a little bit about his history, and then we're going to get into his writings and his story. I'd like to read one of his stories, and we'll have a discussion based on that.
Okay. His name is Tim Boone. He is a native of Wilson, North Carolina. He's a former United States Marine. He served in 1981 to 1992. He was a sergeant. He was also did tours in Beirut and also in the Gulf War. In 1991. He also was a drill sergeant at Parris Island for a while. And he is writing now. And Doug, if you want to read a little bit about that, that would probably introduce him more than anything, a little bit of his writing.
Well, his writings, when I got a hold of this pamphlet and the books and the writings you sent me, Ray, and I read them, it was just astonishing. And as I read it, each time I get something more. Well, Tim, with your permission, I'm going to read one story here, and it's always different when somebody else reads your story versus when you're, you know, reading it yourself and doing it aloud. A Single Leaf by Tim Boone, U.S. Marine Corps. One day, a single leaf was hanging from a branch. I could not help but notice how lonely it appeared since it was attached to the tip of a long branch. I was curious, so I inquired of the leaf to tell me how he ended up being the last on his branch. This is his story. Well, he sighed, I am the last of many that grew and flourished on this branch. Many were with me when my journey started, but as you can see, I stand alone now. As a young leaf, my family and friends did all sorts of things that leaves do. We played flutter in the wind, cast shadow on passing by people, and catch the raindrops. These were fun as a child, but before I knew it, we had become full-grown leaves, and then it was time to make a decision for our future. Some had no choice and were plucked from the branch by passing people who had no regard for the leaf's life. They had just reached up and pulled and tugged until the leaf was taken in a tug. Some were used by angry mothers that grabbed and used the branches as switches, and it was not nice to see. Some were taken by storms that brought fierce wind and rain that swiped many away. Some were abused by passing people who could not stand the thought of us minding our own business and just living the life given to us. Some became depressed and refused dew and rain, which they eventually dried up and died. Some just gave up and fell to the ground. As I looked around after many days, I was the only one left. This is when reality set in on me that though many started with me, many had fallen. He stated that the days came and went so fast, and it was during these times that I needed to hear a voice to help calm the loneliness I felt, and there was none around. When I needed a helping leaf to block the hot sun from scorching me, there was none around. When I needed everyone to stand together and block the wind that blew ever so harshly on stormy days, there was none around. When I became dry and needed someone to give me a drop of morning dew to soothe my thirst, there was none around. Other leaves and other branches tried to support me in my times of depression, but eventually they grew tired, and there was none around. He said, maybe I should do like so many others did and give up and fall to the ground. I'm sure no one will miss me since, like, so many like me have fallen to the ground and are now forgotten. Often thought about letting the sun shine on me till I dry up and become lifeless. But I held out another day. So today I ask myself, how long can I hold on? I dropped my head, for I felt his pain as a thrust inside my heart. It was like I felt every word penetrating the wall I had built up for many years. For a moment I became sad as I looked at my life and seen many similarities of his life. With a tone of sorrow in my voice and heavy heart, this is what I said. I had a nice childhood, as you did. When I became a man, I selected the military as my career. For many years, I served my country to the best of my ability. I was proud and full of life when people would admire my uniform and the bravery I possessed for the training I endured so that I could protect my country and our way of life. One day, as it so happened, conflict came in the world. It was my duty to leave home to fight for the freedom of America and our allies. I did so willingly and without thought, for this is I was trained. However, after it was all done and peace was obtained, it was time to return home. I realized the person that left did not return home. I was experiencing days and days of loneliness and isolation and could not understand why. I became withdrawn and paranoid of those around me on a daily basis. I then noticed that many who had served with me and some who other wars had conflicts had given up and took their own life. Many like me developed physical and mental problems that seemed to consume joy and laughter and the purpose of life. I faced failed relationships and from research found that others did as well. My research found also that in some cases veterans would give up. Some trusted drugs, alcohol, and or pain medications. Some became jobless and homeless from the difficulty of adjustment. Some became and were abusive and violent towards family and friends. I said in my last words, "Yes, you are the only leaf on this branch, and I'm sure there have been days when it was easier just to let go, just end it all. For I too have days as such. However, to answer your question, even when family and friends turn away, when the support of others becomes less, when what they say doesn't matter, when I reach out for help from mental and physical agencies to aid me, with no prevail, you ask, how long can you hold on? One more day. Tim Boone, Semper Fi, United States Marine Corps." Tim, I got tears in my eyes.
I do too.
Tell us your story. I mean, obviously, from what I understand, I mean, you were in Beirut at the barracks, Marine barracks, right before that all got blown up.
Sir. Yes, I was. And we experienced some conflict while I was there, and it was new to me since being away from home for the first time, and I didn't understand what was going on, but as a Marine, you do what you're told to do. So while I was there, I felt like I was okay, but when I came back home, I was just so full of anger and frustration, and no one could deal with me, and I began to shut down, and I started experiencing suicide thoughts, and I did try to commit suicide on sleeping pills, and it was the start of a life that I didn't know was going to ever end. So I kept it to myself. I wouldn't tell nobody what was going on with me because I didn't know. But all I know is that after speaking with my sister is that she said I had changed. I didn't want to talk to nobody. I was just off to myself, and like I was in a daze. But if I didn't know what was wrong with me. Nobody told me that when I came back home, things were going to be different, that I was going to be acting different. I had no clue. And I became so violent with my family and emotional damaged. I didn't know what to do, but kept going. I kept going, and I just suppressed as long as I could. And then after the Gulf War, it came out more. Crying and the anger and frustration, the nightmares and panic attacks and anxiety attacks, the isolation, and it even made me want to more depress it, suppress it, so nobody would know what I was feeling. But at the same time I was doing that, I didn't realize that I was putting myself in a box. And once I got in that box, I couldn't get out. And anyone tried to take me out of the box, I was angry because I felt comfortable in the box as long as I was away from people. But I mean, I didn't understand. And then, you know, the VA telling me, you know, you okay, go on back home. But I knew something wasn't right. I just knew it. just hard to accept. So as time went on, I realized that I wasn't the same person, and it became so violent in the home. When family were telling me that I was violent, I was, no, I'm not, because I couldn't see it. I just couldn't see it. So I would get angry. I would bust out holes in the wall and get up and leave and always threaten to kill people. I was just over the edge. And at the same time, I was afraid of the dark, and I just felt like everyone was trying to get me, and they don't realize this, but my head was getting so full. It was getting so full of pressure from what was going on, because I couldn't figure it out. And they would tell me, go get some help. I would say, no, there's nothing wrong with me. I don't need help. So I just kept denying it. And the more I denied it, the worse it got, until first marriage ended. And then my second marriage started out okay, because she didn't know me, and I kept it inside, and we went on, and the next thing I know, we had some children, two boys, which I love, and it come again. The depression set in, the anger set in, the frustration, the isolation. It got worse this time. I had nowhere to go, because my job was putting pressure on me, and I just didn't understand what was going on, and I became abusive in the home, emotionally abusive. I was just out of control, and she don't know it, but I was trying to figure out why, and she's asking me what's going on, and I'm telling myself, I don't know what's going on, but I didn't want her to intrude on me, because I felt like if she knew that I had this problem, that she would leave me. So I tried to keep it inside, and then I became so bad that I prayed to God to help me fix it. And I had to leave home, because if I hadn't left home, I really believe I would have took somebody's life in the home, because it had got so overbearing. And I didn't know who to tell or who to talk to about, because every time you talk to someone, they tell you, oh, it's okay, it's going to be all right, don't think about it, put it in the past. But you tell yourself, you know, this is harder than what you think it is. So I couldn't find no help. And the pressure got in my mind so tight that I felt the only thing I could do was to take my life. I felt if I could just take a gun and just open my skull up and relieve the pressure, that I could go on, I could fit in. But I just kept living with it. And then years later, it got so bad after I just couldn't do it no more. So I sought out help through the VA, and I've been dealing with a lot of stuff with the VA, because they wasn't the best when I first started. I'm not going to tell a lie, because what do they know about combat? You know, they get out of college and come and tell me what my problems are, and I'm telling you, you know, this is what I feel. And then they tell, no, that's not, you shouldn't feel like that. So they want to dope you up with this medication, and I'm not a medication person, because I didn't try to commit suicide several times with medication, so I didn't want medication. I knew what I would do with medication. So I had to figure out how to get me healed. And so I was introduced to a lot of programs, and finally one, my doctor said, try writing. And I said, no, I don't want to write. Cause even though I had been to college, I had my undergrad degree and my graduate degree, I had lost focus, because the mental health part had taken so much from me that my focus was only 10 to 20 minutes, and I would lose focus. I just couldn't stay alert. I just tired all the time. I was so fatigued. I just didn't know what was going on. And so when offered the opportunity to try this writing to wellness group at the VA, I said, I'll try it. And believe it or not, this writing has saved my life. And I say this, 3 o'clock in the morning, one day, I had reached my bottom. Failure had just overwhelmed me, and suicide, thought thoughts, it just had taken over me. And I was on my knees with the gun in my mouth, and I asked myself, you know, I had just given up. I was ready to just cash it in. And if you don't have no coping skills, to cope with this stuff when it happened, then you're really going to have a hard time. And on my knees, I told myself, if I could write to get this stuff out, see what this is doing to me, to see what it is, maybe I have a chance at life. And that's when I really started digging inside me and writing what comes, my feelings and emotions, what, you know, how this stuff was doing to me, because it would tear at you and tear at you and tear at you. And you're so afraid to tell somebody because they'll look at you and judge you that you don't want to say nothing. So writing saved my life. And on my knees, I wrote that poem called The Visit, because if I hadn't had writing, I would have shot myself in the head. I would have died. I would have died. And I knew I wouldn't have, because I was at the end.
You know, Doug, it seems like it's a classic post-traumatic stress moral injury thing. And it goes across the board. You've dealt with it. I've dealt with it. When I hear Tim, and he and I talk a lot, we're brothers. We're all on the level that we're able to understand, because we've been through things. And you can just, this is not a Stephen King kind of thing of where the nightmare thing. This is real life. And this comes from dying for your country, not in physical way, but in every other way. No greater love than this, that a man would give his life for his friends. And I think Tim's a prime example of that.
I think we've all been there, and, you know, we lost so many friends, and we've seen what's happened. Tim, when you went in the Marines, you went in, what, 1982?
1981.
And so you got in the Marines, you went all the stuff, basic training, and did you get to Beirut right before the bombing? Were you in the barracks and you survived that, or what happened with that?
We were the first ones in when it first started happening. We was the first ones called in to East Beirut, and then we went back out, evacuated Syrians, and then we went back to West Beirut, and that's where we stayed at until to the bombing and everything took place. Being the first ones in, it was a hostile environment. We were set up for all the units that came behind us, the barracks and all the stuff like that. And I had said to myself, being a Marine, I said, you know, this barracks, if I was going to attack, this is such an easy place to attack, because there was no security there, and all the Marines was on, you know, three different floors, and it was an open building. I said, if they're going to attack, this would be the place to attack, because the security, it's just too easy. You know, we're right beside the highway, and I said, if they want to come in, they just come through the gate, and pretty much just soon later, that's what happened. We were just vulnerable.
Well, so you had that stuff, and you were in. Were you a drill sergeant before Desert Storm or after Desert Storm?
Before. I was 1st Battalion, DI, in Paris Island, before I went to Desert Storm.
I mean, you know, U.S. Marine Corps drill sergeants at Paris Island are legendary. I mean,
he gave a lot of trauma.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, right.
when I was at Quantico with the drill sergeants, this is in '74, and it seemed like they were in your face and everything else. I mean, they meant well and everything, but there was just old aura, and that was still in the old traditions, not the new traditions of the Marine Corps and drill sergeants and everything else. But they, I mean, they
you
were
know,
right
I,
in your face.
I remember I was in Beirut. My drill instructor, the way he taught me, was the only thing I had when I got to Beirut. And he, you know, that stuff went a long way. And I told myself, if we ever go to war, I want you to at least know how to react to it, because nobody, you know, my drill instructor taught me, and I want to give you something to take with you, because he told me, he said, if you're ever in a hostile environment and you told an enemy is coming and you told don't move, he said, regardless of what you do, don't move. And that night we was on an attack in Beirut. My sergeant put me down on the ground in a pile of red ants. And we could hear the enemy. We could hear him. And my heart was beating so fast. And all I could remember what my drill instructor said, he said, don't move. You get away your position. And for 4 hours, I laid on the ground while red ants just chewed on me. It just hurt me, because, I, you know, being a 20-year-old Marine, it was kind of hard on me, you know. But I made sure that I trained these Marines, these recruits, that if you're ever in a combat zone, at least you know how to take care of yourself and how to react to the enemy. And I took that with me, and to this day, I remember what my drill instructor said. I might not remember my school teacher, but I know them drill instructors.
You went to Desert Storm. I mean, I was in Desert Storm. I was on the command staff. We were doing the teaching the NBC and then doing the response. But I remember the Marines, we set you guys up. I mean, basically, you went in by Copsey and went north right up along the coast. So that was the primary, you know, exposure to oil well fires and everything else.
Yes. Oh, yes. I can remember days when it just rained, those spots on my uniform. Being in the brown khaki uniform, it was just black with the oil spots and just breathing out stuff. And you dig out your nose and just black with soot. And I got sick over there. And, of course, they told me we don't know what it is. But I got sick. And they told me it was a respiratory infection. And to this day, I have constant bronchitis. It just come and goes. It don't always on me. And I also remember the days when the sun didn't shine and what we had looked like a fog for like days and days, and that stuff was just terrible, you know, just terrible. And you know, you see the dead bodies and the smell of just awful smell. You just don't forget that stuff. And that's where I really started having night terrors, because I was a platoon sergeant. And my bunkmate told me that I was talking in my sleep. And I said, no, I'm not talking in my sleep. I said, I can't talk in my sleep. I'm the platoon sergeant. I got to be strong. And so I didn't know then that I was really breaking down. And it kind of bothered me that it did happen. And so much happened over there. You know, I don't tell people this right here, but my shoes, my boots, didn't have a lot of stuff, and my boots had got so dry rotted that my feet was, I'm walking on the ground, and they're telling me the boots is coming in, but you know, they never came in until that, you know, to after the war was over. And now I got this thing wrong with my feet that I have to have continued treatment with my feet, you know, because I didn't receive adequate uniforms, you know, while I was there. And it's a lot of stuff that went on, you know, that really bothered me. But, you know, I'm just one in many. But I still feel the effects of that place even now, you know. It's just what it is. And
we all do. I mean, one of the things, and again, I don't know if you've ever given the answer if Ray has checked you with this, shared this with you, but what we do know, this is from the reports that I helped prepare from the command staff, the different exposures we had in Desert Storm, obviously with the chemical agents and nerve agents. So we were exposed, and you were exposed, just like I was, to sarin, cyclosarin, to moon, Soman, VX, multiple 7, and Novichoks. Now, these are all nerve agents. And in order to prepare the use of the nerve agents that were provided to Iraq by the United States Army, I want to repeat, provided to Iraq by the United States Army to use on the Iranians, the Iraqi Kurds, and eventually on us, they had those. And so as a consequence of that, we made a decision to the command staff to issue, because there were no options, to issue PB pills, pyridoxamine bromide. These are little 21 foil pack white little tablet that you ate every day. Those are a nerve agent themselves, but the reason that we had those and those were issued is they are a reversible bond for the synaptic junctions and everything else, that if you get hit by these other nerve agents and you take the antidote, which was the Mark I antidote kit, atropine, diazepam, pyridoxamine chloride, that you could recover to function. Well, that didn't happen. And so now we have, and they absolutely did release them, and we blew everything up and released all these nerve agents. Camisea is most famous for it. I mean, Ron Brown and Paul Lyons. I don't know, Ray, have you ever told Tim the story about Paul Lyons?
Oh, I don't think, well, I might have, about the suicide, you know, the loss of Paul, but not in great depth.
And now, they were some ones that revealed all of this stuff on Camisea and 105 sites we blew up. Then we had all the immunizations that we took. Anthrax, botulinum toxin, flu, GG, gamma salbin, all the standard immunizations, everything else. I mean, from smallpox to yellow fever to, I mean, everything else under the sun. Then we had to eat the malarial pills, you know, anti-malaria pills and everything else. On top of that, we had the radiological materials. Now, my tasking, as we talked about on the radio show, was to clean up all the DU-friendly fire. Well, we had a whole host of radiological materials and all the equipment that was destroyed and blown up, and agriculture and industry and everything that was all blowing up. So you had all of those, and then DU itself, which is a nightmare, and I know the Marines were firing DU for sure, all over creation, out of the tanks and, you know, out of the A-10s, and we had the Adam and the Petum, the cluster bombs. We had all the endemic diseases, which were legendary over there. Then all the hazard materials we talked about, I mean, the burn pits didn't start with Iraqi freedom. They started in Desert Storm with General Franks at the 7th Corps. Then we had the total misuse of pesticides, and the pesticide list is staggering. Then we had all the biological agents that we had out there, the oil well fires. I mean, where you were, Tim, and as you just mentioned, and I saw the same thing as I was over there, you didn't see the sun in the middle of the day because of the oil well fires. And that crud just came down on uniform on your skin like mad, didn't it?
It did. Yes, it did.
Well, the chemical compounds that were in the oil well fires included ozone, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, acetylphenylene, benzoanthazine, 5-phenyl, chrysine, fluoroanthrene, phenanthrene, pyrene, particulates, cadmium, chromium, nickel, lead, vanadium, zinc, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, MP xylene, and oxylene, in addition to all the particulates. So that's where we absolutely knew the exposures to be from all those physiological effects. And so when you're describing all this stuff, everybody got sick and everybody went in denial. And as you know, and again, you just mentioned, when you went to the military docs, what did they tell you, Tim?
Well, nothing wrong with me.
When you got to the VA, what did they tell you?
First off, they kept saying, well, nothing wrong. We can't figure out what's wrong with you. Gave me some pamphlet about the mysterious illness. I said, it's not mysterious because I know something wrong with me. You just don't know what it is.
And well, we look at some things you need to know about Veterans Clinician's Guide, the veteran-specific issue issued by the United States Department of Veteran Affairs. Gulf War Syndrome, what we all know, and that covers the whole thing. The physiological symptoms from Gulf War syndromes with all these complex exposures are, by direct quote, fatigue, skin rash, headache, muscle and joint pain, memory loss, shortness of breath, sleep disturbances, diarrhea, and other, in other words, between diarrhea and constipation like a yo-yo. Problems with the skin and tegmatitis, all the rashes and everything else, and the chest pain. That's a summary of what they know. From depleted uranium, which we have talked about, and I know the Marines were zapped, and it was used at Kafshi, and it was used all over the place, and your M60s and your M1 tanks were firing it like mad. When I did the research on depleted uranium in the Nevada test site in 94, 95, I had the Marine gunners come from 29 Palms to shoot the Abrams and the Bradleys for me. God, they were good. I mean, I could have those guys shoot an Abrams tank and then have them shoot a 25 out of a Bradley and have them put them within 6 inches of each other in the target. It doesn't get any better than that. So depleted uranium, sleep problems, mood swings, symptoms in upper and lower and respiratory systems, neuropsychological systems, including memory loss, chronic fatigue, immune dysfunction syndrome, skin rashes, yes, hair loss, aching joints, headaches, abdominal pain. This is all direct quote. Sensitivity to light, blurred vision, menstrual sores, all the birth defects, gastrointestinal systems, again, recurrent diarrhea and constipation, neurological problems, numbness and tingling in your limbs and, you know, all this stuff, mobile chemical sensitivity and birth defects.
And
so we're looking
at
a whole host of known things that the VA knows about. And then we get to the anti-malarial. Oh, I don't know, Ray, you and I don't know how many pills, anti-malarial drugs, you and I ate in Nam, and then Desert Storm. Did you take Larium, Tim?
They marched us to the battalion and gave us some pills and said, this is what you're going to take or get court-martialed. And we started taking pills. They didn't tell us what it was. They just said, take them. And that's what we did. Tell us what it is, what it's for. So you're going to take this or be court-martialed. and the staff sergeants and the, you know, officers went around and made sure we was taking them. And we had, you know, checking our mouth, make sure we swallowed them. That's how that went.
Well, the effects of larium are emotional irritability, panic attack, hallucinations, anxiety, confusion, aggression, depression, psychotic and paranoid reactions, convulsions, visual impairment, manic behavior, aggressive mood swings, and numbness and tingling in the limbs. And that's from the anti-malarial stuff. Now, the same thing comes on down when we keep on going down. We look at the stuff, and we look at it even gets bad. I mean, as we all know when we're terrified, we absolutely know, as you're probably totally aware, Iraq had weaponized anthrax, right? That was a given fact. Well, the weaponized anthrax was given to the Iraq by the United States Army out of Fort Detrick, Maryland. And as a consequence, because we knew we had weaponized anthrax available to them provided by the Army, we knew they would use it because they already had used it on the Iranians. So then we had to make the decision to give the anthrax vaccines. Well, unfortunately, with the anthrax vaccine, they did not have enough doses to cover 750,000 individuals, type 3. Okay, in other words, they need about 23,000 doses, 25,000 doses. And they didn't have it. Okay, 2.5 million doses. They didn't have it. And so then what they did is they put squalene in the anthrax vaccine instead of alum, which changed it. So in other words, every single dose when they replaced it with squalene instead of alum became 3 doses. We didn't have enough for 1 dose per person, so they used squalene, and they end up getting enough for 3 doses per person. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs direct quote, the medical problems from anthrax vaccine, muscle and joint pain, paralysis, chronic fatigue, exhaustion, severe headaches, weight loss, chronic illness, memory problems, numbness in the legs and the hands, spasms or tremors in the limbs, diarrhea, constipation, and cardiac problems. So those are those toxic exposures. And the question comes because I was on command staff trying to teach and we've been trying to get it out. Within the Marine Corps, as all this stuff is beginning and census, Tim, did they tell you of any of this?
No, but pretty much what you name, I deal with the joints, the fatigue, the memory loss. I even was bleeding out of my rectum constantly, and I went to the doctor and they say, well, we can't figure out why you're bleeding. I'm stools are full of blood, and I'm having all these problems, like they said, the nerve problems. And matter of fact, this year I've just been diagnosed with melanoma in my eyes, and it's just one issue after the other issue. And all they can say is, well, you know, we can just treat you, but we don't know what's going on with you. I understand exactly what you're talking about, and those symptoms are live, and I'm living with them every day. I wake up every morning. Matter of fact, if I go to sleep, that's a good day if I can get an hour of sleep at night. I'm in pain 24 hours a day. I'm having problems, and sometimes I go to the VA to get help. The first thing they want to tell me, well, ain't nothing wrong with you. We're giving you medication. You need to try this and try that. And I'm trying what they're telling me, and I'm telling them something ain't right. But I know that when I came back from Desert Storm, that something went right with my body because they already diagnosed me with a weak immune system, and then they diagnosed them with constant bronchitis, and chronic bronchitis, and other stuff, and rashes, and headaches. And matter of fact, even now I'm having blackouts now that I can't even maintain myself. I'm falling out all over the place. And then you go there and tell them this stuff, and, you know, they're not getting nothing wrong with you. What are they saying?
You know, the writing that Tim does is almost a window into the mind, and you can see a lot of things working on his body and his mind and everything. And if you read the poetry and you read the stories that he's written, and it's almost like a window that you can see the inside of Tim, what's going on. You can see the outside too, but you can see the inside that is working on him pretty bad. I think the writing reveals Tim that he, you know, I think they encourage him to write really deep, and when they do that, they expose that inner self that is being tormented. And, you know, when you read that story a while ago, it touched all of our hearts. But that's the part he can't really say, but it's like that is the part that needs to be heard.
Tim, you talk about the man in the glass. Tell us about that story, how it came about, and just a little bit of it, because it's incredible. It's long, but it's incredible.
Well, I finally got a chance to look at me, and after countless times of people get tired of you. I'm just gonna be real. Family, they love you, but they get tired of you complaining about what's going on with you. At some point they want you to get better, but you're not getting better. So when I begin to look at myself, as far as the man in the mirror, I can see the person, but I'm helpless, just so helpless. I can't help this person. And as this person reach out for help, it's like they want to help you, but they tired of helping. So when I look at me in the mirror, it's just frustrating because I want to be like everybody else. I want to laugh. I want to have joy. I even get jealous when I see people enjoying life because I want to do that. And it's like it's impossible, but I really try at it. But when I look at myself, I'm nobody, and I'm trying to be somebody, but it's just stuff that, like, I'm forgotten.
One of the things that has impressed me about Tim from the very beginning, Doug, you've seen some people laugh, and sometimes it's a phony laugh, sometimes it's kind of half laugh. Tim has I think he has got a good heart, and I think he has a laughter there that maybe nobody's really capitalized on. But Tim and I are on the same level a lot of times, and I have received a lot of help, and I thank the Lord for it. And I was never exposed to a lot of chemicals and things. As far as malaria, I love malaria. Malaria was the best thing that happened to me in Vietnam. I loved it. I spent a week in a hospital in a real bed and a real ward and air conditioning and TV.
And you had a bath.
Yeah, I had a bath. I had about three baths, actually. three of the half, that was half of the ones I had in Vietnam, actually. But, I was never exposed to the thing that you guys were exposed to. But I know from the internal part, Tim and I have some great conversations. He's one of my closest friends because we're on the same level. We can talk. You and I talk, Doug, and I don't usually talk to people about me. Because there is a part of us. I talk about, when I do a program, I talk about the man in the mirror, and I talk about the little man inside of us. And there was a song one time that said, "Inside this armor, the warrior is a child." And I think that's a little part of me sometimes. They call it the little room syndrome in the back of your head that you shove all this mess in, anger, frustration, abandonment, all these things, and you can't talk about it. And you will visit it once in a while, and we put a lock on the door of it. Nobody goes in that. You don't share it with nobody. And I think what they did in this writing program, it was called, the program itself is called Peer Support Writing to Wellness, is that they have encouraged those guys to open that door up and take a light in there and shine around and maybe share the inside of that room with people. And Tim has received a lot of healing from this, from sharing sometimes.
Yes.
Because people are able to see the wounded little guy inside of him. That's a hard thing for a man to say sometimes. But I think that's what that writing group does. And it's pretty amazing.
You know, this group is so to my heart. We go in this group and we sit down and we have a fabulous instructor. And she, we read our writings and then we comment on our writings. And you hear other stories from other military people. And there's not a dry eye in the group when we begin to share what's going on the inside, because this is the only group that I've ever been in where I'm able to reach down inside and share what's inside of me, because the more I can get out, the less I have to deal with. And I'm to the point where I want to heal, and if I got to tell what's going on inside with me, I'm willing to do that, because I have met so many military people who don't want to share nothing, and I keep telling them, you got to get this out, then it's going to kill you. You got to get it out. And if I can encourage somebody to reach down inside and get this out of them, they'll be surprised how it make them feel, because the longer you hold on to it, the longer it drives you, it controls you, and I want control of some of me back. I might not have it all, but I want some back. And this writing group is giving me the ability to have some control in my life. If just a speck is better than none. And I love this group, and I won't take nothing for it. It's one of the things that the VA have done that I'm proud of.
Doug, one of the things I do in the program sometimes is I'll pick an object, maybe 4 ounces heavy, and I'll get someone to hold it, and I'll get them to hold it out. And I'll ask them, how much does it weigh? And they'll say, oh, I don't know, 4 ounces. So I'll be talking, and then I'll make the person hold it, and I'm talking, and then I'll ask them, how much does it weigh? It's like, wow, man, 8 ounces now. No, it didn't gain weight. It's just the longer you hold something, the heavier it becomes. And, you know, after a while, you think it weighs about 5 pounds because it's still 4 ounces, but you're holding it, and it becomes heavier and heavier and heavier.
Yes. So well, I mean, that's where that's what's happening to the soul, because when it's deep inside there and you're struggling with everything,
right,
the soul can only hold so much before it's going to break.
True. That's true. That's just the way we are, and I think they're really figuring this out as they go. You know, they used to say, well, a doctor is always practicing on people, because they call it a practice. And I think they do evolve as they go, and they learn more about the inner self and the moral injury, and that's one of the new phenomena that they're coming up with the military in the last couple of years, really, is the moral injury is a very vital part of this thing, of where a lot of people, post-traumatic stress is fear-based. You fear like your life was being taken. Moral injury is really a guilt and shame-based, of where we violate our conscience by listening, doing, seeing, acting, perpetrating. And so they're finding out a lot of these guys are coming back home, and instead of everybody being, they're thinking everything is entailed in that PTSD, but it's not, because they have to deal with both aspects of the human spirit and the human body and the mind, because a lot of it is moral injury, and they're just getting into that area.
Well, I think what Tim has described, and we see throughout here and all over the place, I mean, go into the drug and alcohol abuse again on this document, and so many people that have struggled with this stuff, they've gone to drug and alcohol abuse. I mean, either they're abusing their prescribed medications or they're abusing street drugs. And, you know, from our work in law enforcement, that's a nightmare beyond comprehension. And then they abuse alcohol. I mean, all of us have gone through that period, you know, in Vietnam and after Vietnam, or Desert Storm, where alcohol seemed to be your friend because, well, you know, hey, you could be numb and dead for a few minutes and have fun. You don't have to worry about it.
Sure.
But then I came to the realization many, many years ago, hey, you know, I had to get ready to go drinking. I had to go drinking. Then I had to recover from drinking. I had to do exactly what I had to do before I went to go drinking, and all I did was pay to pee.
True.
And all of a sudden, I didn't drink.
I would drink and feel good, and everybody would be laughing at my jokes, and a few more drinks, I would become obnoxious, and they weren't laughing anymore, and a few more drinks, I threw up on somebody, and that would be the end of the party. And so it's a downward spiral many times. We're self-medicating ourselves. That's what we're trying to do. And you can't do that because you always over-medicate yourself, and we have to seek help. And the VA has become a good place. And you can get help. With the moral injury, I'm going to tell you the truth, Doug, and I'm a chaplain, and we're good friends, and we both, you know, understand these things. But if you're going to get healed from a moral injury, there are real things you can do to help alleviate that. But the true healing comes from asking God to help me, forgive me. Lord, I was not in my right mind. And asking some people. You know, forgiveness, I think, is really the key to healing moral injury. You ask forgiveness, they ask forgiveness, we all able to move on through life, pretty much, anyway. But
you know, I think that when we look at the forgiveness and everything else, you know, yeah, we ask for forgiveness for what we were involved in, you know, the fact that, yeah, hey, we dropped the bombs on Christmas morning. I've told that story before. I was just a young puppy. I was, barely had my diapers changed when I did that. And then setting everything up with the DU munitions and come to the realization. But then the other part is, and this is for me the real depth of moral injury, is the abandonment, as Tim has described. There's nothing wrong with you. Go on. We don't know what it is. Just go on. We can't help you. Just go on. And that abandonment or that betrayal on top of the fact that, wait a minute, they lied to me. I mean, I don't think, Vietnam vet, and you and I are both Vietnam vets, and so many of our friends are and everything else. I mean, we jumped in the Gulf of Tonkin incident, triggered the whole thing in massive involvement. And then we look back on history today and we go, it never happened.
Yeah.
I mean, Desert Storm was a sham. Operation Iraqi Freedom and Durin were a sham. And then I have to deal with that. How do I deal with the moral injury resulting from that these were really shams? Totally in contrast to what our fathers had to do with the Nazis and all that. I mean, there's totally different perspectives, totally different things.
Well, I think with personally, when I was writing, my first time I wrote the VA, before I ever wrote my book, The Never-Ending War, I was in a therapy thing, and the therapist had me to write a story of the worst incident in my Vietnam experience. It was when my platoon was wiped out. I wrote the story, and I gave it to her. I thought it was pretty good, and she never looked at it. She said, will you do it again? And she had me to do it four times, and really, I got really upset about it, but I did what she wanted, and each time I wrote it, I went to more detail, reached down, and by the time I finished writing the fourth one, I had dug out stuff I had buried a long time ago, and I really felt better about it. And through that, I was able to write my book and bring out more emotions, personal emotions, sometimes exposing my fear, my anger. I could hold a lot of hostility feelings, or feelings of hostility, against a lot of people that did bad things sometimes, leadership problems and all these. Why didn't they see it? Why didn't they know it? And they sent us in there, and it's almost like they knew that we were going to get ripped up. But Doug, somewhere along the line, I have to say, God, not only forgive me, but help me to forgive these people so I can move on. I can never confront them. I can never face them again. Some of them are dead. I just have to take care of me. That's the only thing I know of. And I'm able to move on in life and try not to hold against them anymore. And so I know it sounds simple, and I know it sounds maybe, I don't know. But I know personally I've been able to move on a lot of things, and I don't even think about it. I'm like, when it comes up in my mind, I'm thinking, I'm not thinking about that anymore.
It's just Tim, we have to drill take... sergeant, what are your feelings from a drill sergeant perspective?
Well, I think that as far as training Marines, it is not, they're not going enough in depth now. Because I think they need to put a psychological part in the training now, because you got to have something to take with you to help you deal with stuff. And if we're not, it's good to teach you how to be killed and ready for, to fight. But you need something that when the fighting is over, that you can rely on. And that's what we're missing out on the training. That at some point you need to teach these new Marines that, if you go into combat, this is how you're going to feel when you come out of combat. Because we need a roadmap to say, this happened, that happened, this happened. Then you might need to seek treatment. Okay. That's the part that's lacking. If you just can't teach them one side, you need to teach them all of them. Because when you come back, you messed up. And I want to say this right here. I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't do drugs. So my issues was just more extreme because I didn't have nothing to suppress it. And I was sitting here thinking when y'all was talking about the morals that if I could have drank some alcohol, I would have, just to suppress what was going on with me. But I never had that stuff, so I had to deal with it head on. But if these Marines, Army, military, teach the soldiers that, if you go into a combat zone, This is what you're going to feel when you come out.
True.
Don't be scared to tell us. Tell us what we're going to feel like. Because when you come out and the comment zone goes around your family, they don't know. They think something wrong with you. You know, well, you're in the military, you've been in combat. Nobody, everything is hush, hush, hush. I want to know. And I want these young Marines and sailors and Army and sailors to know that something clicked in you when you come out of a combat zone. You're not going to be the same. And you better know what's going on with you because ain't nobody going to tell you. So if I got an idea on something that's going to change about me, at least I know how to seek some treatment and seek some help. And that's the part about training that needed instilled in training, that you're not going to be the same if you go into a combat zone or any hostile environment. This is what's going to happen to you. And they need that, and they should incorporate it. And not only that, when they get out of the military, when I got out, we had 5 days of transition, and 3 days was counsel. So I didn't even get that. So you pretty much put out on your own.
I know when I came, I don't know, we've talked about this, when I came back from Vietnam the first time, I just came back and went on my life. And then when I came back from the second time, I mean, I got out, and I started college immediately. And then when we went to Desert Storm, I got pulled out of college, just basically went to my office desk and said, gone to war, hopefully I'll be back, and took off. And we got done. Signed out with, you know, the general and said, hey, all the friendly fire vehicles are ready. They're all contained. We're ready to ship them out. They're loaded on the row. You can tape. And Pagonas said, told his master sergeant, okay, put Doug on an airplane. Mm. You know, so off we're going. I mean, when I came back from Vietnam, from the last time I had my last B-52 mission until I was sitting in a VFW back home with all my family and my friends and my parents and my best friend's parents' 25th wedding anniversary, wasn't probably even 36 hours.
Hmm.
Today, I mean, you get pulled out and thrown back into the environment where everything has changed and everything around you has changed. I mean, when we go to war, the family has to assume other responsibilities, fulfill what we have left in our, that we did while we were gone. And we can't be concerned during wartime with what the heck is happening back home, can you? I mean, Ray, speak to this, please.
Well, you know, we didn't have Skype. We didn't have things. But I know in combat, you cannot be distracted from that combat. And even when people write in letters, you got to be. They really need to talk to parents and families and wives or spouses, because that guy, if he gets distracted, he could hesitate sometime. And when you hesitate or you get your mind off of things, you just can't function right. They say that a lot of guys lost their life in the last week of Vietnam, for instance, because they were so, their mind got on coming home and forgot about the danger at hand. And in any kind of dangerous thing that you're doing, whether it's in combat or whether it's just life itself, you've got to focus on what you're doing or you will become a victim. And, you know, I'm glad we didn't have Skype because I didn't need the daily news. We didn't have radios, Doug. We couldn't even carry radios in the bush. And so we had no contact. One guy snuck one time that I remember, and we heard on the radio that they were walking on the moon, and we were getting ready to go to Mutter's Ridge. We were in the jungles actually going to Mutter's Ridge. And I thought to myself, I think I'd rather be on the moon. And it turned out to be a bad vacation, let me tell you. So I think it's when a man goes into war, be careful what you tell him. Try to motivate him. Try to help him. Try to help his family out so he's not worried about him so much.
You know what our motivation speech was? They had us together and they said, all right, men, we're getting ready to go into war. We outnumber 4-1, so that means you're going to die.
Hey, no. Tim, we got about 3 or 4 minutes, sir, and I'd like to close this off with you saying what you think, how you feel, what your recommendations are, how the veteran, how the Marine, how everybody can thrive. I mean, it's yours to say anything that you want to do for the last 2 or 3 minutes here, please, sir.
Well, I appreciate y'all letting me come up here and speak. And I hope I can tell somebody that's going through what I go through that there is help out there if you seek it, that you can't fix yourself on your own. There's no need for you to hurt your family and your loved ones, no need to want to injure someone, strangers you don't even know on the street, because there is help. And suppressing this
It's not going to help you. You got to get it out if you want to have a good life. And I know it hurts to get out, and it hurts to stay in. But the more I get out, the better I feel on the inside. And there is programs, and I do praise this peer support and writing group because it has changed my life. And if you want, every program is not going to be for you. You have to use what's best for you. And if you can find something that works, stick with it, because there is help if you want help. But you can't fix yourself by yourself. And your family deserves better. You deserve better, and society better. And all you got to do is just put yourself forward. And don't be like me, who keep holding it in, thinking it's just going to go away, because it won't go away. And I appreciate all y'all time, and I hope somebody tomorrow go out and seek help, because there is help.
Tim, God bless you. Thank you. Your writings, we need to get these out all over. We'll share them here by the network. God bless you, Tim. Thank you. United States Marine forever, I guess that's what it is, Ray, isn't it? God bless you, and good evening.